listening to The After Show, the bonus episode series for On Tour with Brian Ray. This is a production of iHeartRadio and Black Barrel Media, and I'm your host, Mandy Wimmer. In The After Show, we dive a little deeper into Brian's thoughts about certain parts of the interviews, as well as expound a bit more on his own experiences on tour. In previous after shows, we dabbled in how sex, drugs, and rock and roll all go hand in hand. But in this episode, we tackle it head on. From Matt's coke running days, to the fairly hedonistic parties, to people going missing on tours, to the stories of those who survived addiction, and to those who sadly did not, like Velvet Revolver and Stone Temple Pilots frontman Scott Weiland. In contrast, we cover a lot of hysterical moments in Matt's interview, including the remarkable partying ability and work ethic of Slash and Keith Richards. And we examine if there is any red underwear left in the world after Matt Sorum fulfilled his show day superstitions. Here's my conversation with Brian Ray. Episode 7, Matt Sorum.
Hey, Mandy. Mandy Wimmer, my producer.
Thank you for inserting the British accent.
Oh, yes. You got it.
You know I can't do a British
accent. Gratuitous and not good.
Yeah. I get really jealous when people do accents because I cannot do them to save my life.
Best not to try that.
No, I won't try. Okay. I'm not going to embarrass myself. Anyway, Matt Sorum, I have to say, I laughed out loud multiple times during this interview.
Yeah.
I mean, and editing this interview, this interview was actually about two plus hours long. And
right.
So editing this interview was a treat to get it down to 1 hour. There's so many great stories on the cutting room floor. I really wish we could put it all out. It just would have been way too long. But anyway, what we did put out is great and absolutely hysterical. And we are going to start right away with where we started in the interview. And that is the cocaine running days.
Whoa.
You, as everybody knows, have had your time in the sun with drugs.
Yes.
But this is over the top. I mean, my heart was racing hearing these stories about him strapping kilos of coke to his chest and flying to Hawaii and doing drops and then coming back with thousands of dollars. I mean, I don't know. And he did this for years. I cannot think of anything more stressful. Were you ever on that side of it? Or what were your thoughts of that story?
I would have made a terrible dealer. I would have definitely used up all the profits in my nose or in my lungs. You know what? When you're a young musician trying to make it, you've got big dreams. None of those dreams have come true yet. You got to make ends meet. So what? Yeah, run a couple of drugs. Hey.
But what, I mean, have you guys not heard of like serving in a restaurant or maybe Starbucks or like, you know, doing something on the side? I mean, like drugs is the
only
option.
And make like what, $9?
Oh my God. But it's honest at least, and you're not going to jail.
Yeah, but then you're not a renegade badass.
I really don't know how you guys are still among us.
I don't either.
I mean, was that though? Okay, so but to wrap this up, was that hearing that story, was your heart racing like mine, or were you just like, this is entertaining?
It was all news to me. I had no idea that he had that sordid tale in his past, but it's hilarious. You know, he and I, just so the audience knows, we're both a couple of sober men. We talk about that. You know, we both have been in recovery for a long time. And so between us, that stuff is hilarious.
Now,
we laugh our heads off over that stuff all the time when we see each other and talk about our exploits because it's funny. These are the tales of survivors.
Right.
Now, sadly, for every one of those stories of a survivor, there are thousands of stories of people who didn't survive. So it's not that cute. But in this this case, while we're talking about, you know, an 80s style R-A-W-K rock musician, it's hilarious.
So really, the cult is what brought Matt out of his drug smuggling days. He got an audition for the cult, thank God, because actually the person who took his spot was then arrested and spent 10 years in federal penitentiary, which is insane and crazy. But that's what happens when you smuggle drugs. Don't do it.
Yeah, that's right. Then you join a cult.
No, not the
cult.
Oh my God. Oh my God. So he actually says he's been in so many amazing bands, but he says that the Cult was actually, as a lot of people have said, apparently the best fit for him as a drummer. So I really enjoyed the Cult. I believe I had one of their CDs back in the day, but knowing what I know of Matt as a person, I didn't realize he was a drummer at that point. I don't see that as like the best fit. Like, I see him more as like straight GNR.
Yeah, I can see what he's getting at there with a Cult. That's a very straight ahead eighth note band, whereas GNR had a bit more swing and variety of feels. Maybe Matt is talking about that he's probably better at that more straight ahead style. Maybe that's what he means.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, I don't really know, but I thought that was that it was interesting also that he had to change his entire appearance to wear all black to fit in with the Death Cult.
Yes, the Death Cult.
Okay, so another laugh out loud moment in this interview was when Slash and Duff, I think it was, came to a Cult show. That's how they met Matt. And then Matt, coming off that tour, I think 180 days or something like that. I don't know. You hear it in the interview. But he got walking pneumonia. He was home with his mom. His mom was taking care of him, which is so cute. And Slash calls his house. And his mom says, "There's someone named Slush on the phone for you." Oh my God. It's like, it's such a mom thing to say. That is so cute.
Next time I see Slash, I'm going to call him Slush.
Well, the best part about this is that story. That is just great. But Slush says to Matt, "Our drummer is in rehab, and so we need a new drummer." Okay, so then Matt, having walking pneumonia, goes and basically auditions or starts working with them the next day while having pneumonia. So, I mean, obviously there's no stop switch for him. But then we're going to talk about drugs a little bit longer because I find this really interesting that their drummer's in rehab. Matt comes to take the place of the drummer and he finds out that everybody in GNR is on heroin. And everyone's like falling asleep. He's like, it's like an opium den, which I think straight like Deadwood or Tombstone or something like that, opium den. But then, so he credits himself for getting the band to do more cocaine.
Well, you know, when you're going nowhere, you want to get there as fast as possible. No, GNR was clearly going places, and it's hard to go places when you're sleeping. Unless, of course, you're a sleepwalker.
Okay.
But anyway,
we're not going to get into that right now.
We're not going to get into that right now. But people, that's for another episode. You can ask in your questions about the sleepwalking. I will talk about it at some point.
I might never talk about it, but
well,
Brian,
I
can
will
talk about it.
Anyway, yeah, I mean, that's hilarious. The drugs have taken control of the band and they're all like nodding out all day long. And then Matt convinces them that a better drug would be cocaine. But guess what? They didn't stop doing heroin. They did both.
I mean, so what happens? Like, so cocaine obviously makes you really hyper and heroin puts you to sleep. Is that the difference, basically, in a nutshell?
Basically, yeah, in a nutshell, yeah.
Okay, so like if you're doing both, then I don't even understand what you would be like if you're
doing
both.
You'd be giving your heart a real hard time because your brain is going fast, but your mouth's still going slow.
I don't understand. Had you guys never heard of like soda or coffee or anything like that? I mean, I've worked insanely long hours doing Super Bowls. I mean, 18-hour days, 7 days a week. And I don't recall at any point looking at my events team and saying, "We really need to get some cocaine in here."
Well, you would have been sent to jail if you did because, you know, the NFL isn't really kind towards drug addiction. But, you know, you used exorbitant amounts of caffeine.
That's true. That was our drug of choice.
There
was
you
caffeine.
Go.
That'll
work the way you do it. It'll work. It's like rocket fuel.
It is. It actually is.
I've seen you work.
I guess I am addicted to caffeine.
There's a fresh cup over here right now. Let me look in there. Halfway down, still warm. It's a fifth cup.
It goes with me everywhere. I am never without my coffee.
It's like a sippy cup. Do you have like one of those helmets with a hose that goes like coffee all day?
I should actually have one.
I think that's a good idea.
Then I don't have to keep going back for refills. It takes way too much time.
Perhaps you could do some Starbucks branding on the side. Thank you.
So very, very, very funny. So we brought in the Rolling Stones in this episode, Keith Richards. This was another laugh out loud moment for me when Matt was talking about the work ethic of bands. I mean, among all of the drugs and all of the alcohol, they also play shows.
Wow.
I know. They also record albums. I mean, I don't know how this all gets done.
You have to do something to afford all those drugs.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. So
we're paying them for their music.
Keith Richards is probably the biggest icon for how is he still functioning as a human with all of the drugs and the smoking. And I'm sure the alcohol, I don't know Keith personally, so I don't know what all he does, but in his shows, he's smoking. So, I mean, that you do see that all the time. And he's known as a party animal, of course. So Matt talks about a story about how Axl was late to a sound check or something like that with the Rolling Stones, and Keith Richards looks at him and says, "I slept in a chandelier last night. What's your excuse?" And Matt talks about going missing in Venezuela, and they find him on some hotel balcony. I don't think a hotel he was staying in. Matt's point in the story was that Slash has the best work ethic of just about anybody, where he can be out all night partying and he can still be at soundcheck at noon. Is that a thing? Like back in your heyday, were you struggling to actually do your job?
No, there were times there where, like, I remember being in, I think it was Chile, when I was playing with Laura Branigan in the mid 80s, back when all the drugs were still working for me. You'd have jet lag, and these were very long flights. So we had found out about a sleeping pill, and it was a very strong but over-the-counter sleeping pill down there in South America, in Chile. And so apparently you could take half of one of these tiny little pills and you'd be out for your whole flight back.
Wow.
I was excited about that because I don't sleep that well on a flight.
Wait, was this legal or not legal?
Yeah, legal there.
It was legal there. Okay.
Probably not supposed to have it here.
Okay.
You can't pronounce the name and they don't know what it is. So they'll view it as illegal.
Oh,
anyway, so, I had to sample some.
Of course.
While I was down there. And then I took smuggled a couple home, you know, but this is lightweight
stuff. So you were a smuggler.
What? I was.
You lied.
Okay, a little bit, but not for money. That's the thing. Smuggling is for money.
Oh, got it. Okay.
Just bringing in a little something, something.
Those of us non-drug addicts and non-smugglers don't really understand these things, we have to be told.
But anyway, that was when I was coming to the end of my drug abuse and alcohol abuse career in the mid-80s. It was still kind of working, but kind of not really. But anyway, I brought it. One of the guys, I should say this, one of the guys in the tour, a guitar tech for the other guitar player, went to a strip club and he went to go enjoy himself down in Chile and woke up at 10 in the morning out in an alley with his wallet gone. Well, they'd given him a whole one of these things and he was out like a lot.
Out.
Yeah, they put him out. So it's a little bit dangerous, yeah. But in general, yeah, for myself, I didn't have too difficult of a time with balancing work and those things. But at a certain point, I knew that the gig was up. And at a certain point, I had friends later tell me after I was sober, "Man, that session, you looked rough." And I'm like, "What session?"
Oh my God.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, you just learn. And hopefully, you know, like in my case and in Matt's case, we found another path where we could find a life truly worth living that was a lot better and rewarding without all that chaos and danger.
Okay, so there's one part of this that I mean, a lot of it was very funny now, obviously, in looking at all of this stuff retrospect. And then there was part of it that made me cringe a little bit. Some of it we've already talked about. So the other part of it that I really think that we need to address is the hedonistic nature of rock and roll. And the fact that you guys talk about how it was a time and that time has changed. He talks about this story where people are rolling down the aisles of the 727 as they're taking off and everybody's sleeping with everybody and they're picking up girls in strip clubs in Houston and sending them back home on a Southwest ticket. I mean, it's just chaos. I mean, it was pure chaos, right? And I mean, me as a female, of course, I'm cringing hearing this story. But Matt talks about how he looks back on it, again, not with pride, but and recognizes that it was very hedonistic, but that he has completely changed now at this point. But what are your thoughts on that time versus this time and how rock and roll was versus how it is now? And do you guys have more respect than you showed?
Oh, yeah, we do. Trust me, look in my eyes. You're looking right at me. I know there's a devilish glint, but there is respect behind that devilish glint. No, it's not like a Me Too moment. It's more like a Me 14 moment. It's terrible. But, you know, I guess rock and roll went through a phase, and some would say that that was its death rattle,
yeah.
To be honest with you. What started out in rock and roll, in my opinion, was a fantastic outlet for teens and people of any age who needed that outlet, full of energy, danger, the forbidden thing, and fun and rebelliousness. But it turned into just like, you know, hedonistic, you know, navel gazing, excess and abuse of people and drugs, you know, and it's sad, but that's what happened to rock and roll, unfortunately.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Now, I do think that it's important that we say that Matt is, you know, the poster child of the fact that people do actually change.
I don't know about poster child.
What Matt word would you
isn't
use?
Isn't an example of someone who might have changed. No, Matt is happily married and they have a kid on the way. And, you know,
he's sober,
long time. He's an industrious man. He does charity work. And,
tons of charity work, yeah.
He's trying to rub out a record. What can I say? And they just, you know, they live really close to my getaway pad in Palm Springs. And yeah, he's a very good dude. Yeah.
Yeah, no, completely. I mean, very, very impressive how he's, you know, done all of this, but now is so different. So next time someone says to you, people don't change, refer them to the Matt Sorum episode. On
That's
tour.
Right, here. Exhibit A.
Yes. Yes, they do change. So, okay, the last thing that I want to talk about kind of in the Guns N' Roses heyday is when Axl does end up firing Matt and he leaves his firing. He goes home. He lives in this huge rock star pad and he pulls into his garage and he finds a black Porsche in his garage and he rolls in a black Porsche. He now has two black Porsches because he literally forgot about the first one.
I know. It's so hard. It's tough. I mean, finding your way in the music business can be so challenging.
I mean, I think that that's a new life goal. Have enough money that you're buying two cars because you
forgot. Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, if I had that much money, I would spend it all on, I would give it all to animal shelters. Let's be real.
That's nice.
You know, but it's a fun thing to think about.
And you wouldn't forget that you'd given to an animal.
No, I would not.
Right.
I would
exactly.
Just, and it wouldn't matter. I just keep giving. Things we're gonna wrap it up here. We did talk about the semi-glamorous side of the drug business, which we don't condone, but there is kind of a sad side to this as well. When Matt Sorum was with Velvet Revolver, the front man of that band was Scott Weiland or Weiland?
Weiland,
okay. Who lost his life to addiction.
Yeah.
Very, very, very sad. He was the frontman also for Stone Temple Pilots, an amazing band. You know, I didn't know much about Scott, but what was your experience with him?
Yeah, well, I got to meet Scott. Lovely guy. We rehearsed one day and then played a big charity on the beach in Santa Monica behind a large mansion. And it was just one of those sort of all-star bands. It was Matt on drums, Dave Kushner also from Velvet Revolver on guitar, and a bunch of other people, Steve Jones from the Sex Pistols. And I did a handful of songs with Scott Weiland singing, and he was a great performer, really magnificent, very charismatic, an interesting singer, had a very good voice. As you said, Stone Temple Pilots is a really important band from the 90s. And so his contribution to that era of rock and roll, when grunge music came to save rock and roll, which had gone so far south and so far into the excess of the 80s, they were one of the bands that led the charge to try to save rock and roll. And so imagine my sadness when I saw that Scott Weiland was struggling with drugs and alcohol to a great degree, and basically was never able to control that. And though he tried, he could never slay that dragon. And his demons won out. And unfortunately, there's no more Scott Weiland, except in video and in recordings. And it's a shame. It's a real shame.
Oh, man. Yeah. A complete shame. So we're gonna end this on a light note, because I think that probably one of the funniest parts of this interview was when Matt was talking about his superstitions that he does not do as much anymore, but did do them at one time for a long time, and they were literally laugh out loud funny. Hopefully you heard them in the episode, but one of them was that he would have to wear red underwear every single night when he played. I cannot imagine the amount of red underwear that must be. I hope he had a red underwear sponsor.
There's all of the red underwear on earth is now gone, basically. That's why he doesn't do it as much anymore.
Matt Sorum has all the earth's red underwear. And then he had to chew gum for the first three songs. And as we all know, they only take pictures of the first three songs in the press pit. So, and as you know, there's nothing that I hate worse than people chewing gum. So
yes.
I was completely on board with that one going away.
I've heard that about you. The truth is that when you chew gum and somebody's taking a photo, you're likely to be making a funny face if you're in the middle of chewing gum.
Well, I don't think anyone looks attractive while chewing gum.
Yeah.
Picture or no picture, no one looks attractive chewing gum. I'm going on the record with that.
But let's just talk about the sound of chewing gum. That's not good either.
No, I can't even go there. Absolutely disgusting. Okay, so the last one, his absolutely hysterical. So Matt had a chrome chain that he had to wear at every single show. And on his way from his dressing room to the stage at a Guns N' Roses show, he realized he didn't have it, and he starts screaming at his golf cart driver that he's got to go back. He has to go back. He cannot go on stage without this chain. Oh my God, just absolutely hysterical. So you have your ring that Johnny Holiday gave you that's been brought up in a few of these after shows. I mean, how dire is it that you have this ring on? I mean, can you not perform? Would you have a horrible show? Would you have a great show and then go cry backstage? Like, how do you get through it?
Well, you know, I don't think that I would have a struggle doing the show or crying after, although I might, but I might do that anyway. No, I don't think that it would be a struggle to do a show without it. It's just that it became a part of me. Ever since Johnny Holiday gave me that ring in whatever that was, 2000, it's been on my finger, on my right hand, my middle finger, for every show that I've played since then. So I think I would just feel naked without it. And I don't think I've played a single show without it. And I almost lost it in New York City. I almost lost the ring. We checked out of our hotel there, and I'm on the way to the airport in our SUV, and I go, oh my God, my heart just sank. I don't have my ring on. And then my head instantly went to, I remember taking it off on top of the bed. And so I instantly call our tour manager, Phil, and say, Phil, this is a crazy request. I don't do this to you often, but would you please see if you can get the keys to my room on the 33rd floor and go in there and see if you can find my big old ring. It's probably right in the middle of the bed. And he goes, will do. And he called me back in like 10 minutes. He says, I got it.
Oh, thank God.
And I'm like, oh my God, you can't imagine what I was stressed out over that one.
That happened to me in a hotel once. I left my prized ring in the bathroom, and I called them immediately, but it mysteriously could not be found.
Yeah, I think we've all got sad stories about that, but this is a story that ended on a happy note.
Thank God, because it is one of your faves. All right, so we are going to wrap up with the lightning round. First question, music related. Who is the one artist that you are a pretty big fan of that people might not expect?
Interesting. Let me see here. That's a good question. Little Feat, a band from the very late 60s, early 70s, and all through the 70s and 80s, kind of multi-ethnicity, cross-genre. It's sort of like R&B, rock and roll, sometimes rootsy, sometimes country. And I loved him. I was so addicted to that band. Also, Ry Cooder. There was a time when that's all I listened to, those two bands.
Do you still listen to them now?
Not as much now. Mm-hmm. I mean, but that's also because I wore it out.
Right.
I listened to it every day, all day, on tour, off tour, all the time.
Right. Okay, so the non-music related question. If you could live anywhere outside of the United States, where would you live?
Canada. Or France?
Canada or France?
Yes.
Interesting. So why Canada?
Or Buenos Aires.
I know you love France. You said that that's your favorite place to tour. Buenos Aires, let's go there.
Okay, let's go there.
Okay. So what is it about Buenos Aires that you love?
Buenos Aires. Okay, so that place is magnificent. It is its own architecture, its own vibe, very different from any South American city. It's got a lot of art deco architecture, and I'm, as you know, very into architecture. So it's got a lot of this sort of 20s and 30s architecture, sort of one of the main features is big round corners instead of, 90 degree angles, very rounded.
Right.
And the city was planned by one of the people that helped to plan Paris, the way the city of Paris ended up sort of expanding out was sort of very similar to the way Buenos Aires is. And it just feels like a European city rather than being in South America. And I just love it down there. And the people are also so friendly and so fun.
You've toured there with the Bayonets as well, haven't you?
I have, and solo a few times.
Okay.
Yeah, I've gone down there a few times.
Yes, you've been there a lot. Yeah. Awesome.
Well, it's a great rock and roll crowd in Buenos Aires.
Right,
It's just wonderful. But and then Canada, because for the most part, they speak English. And I find that comforting because I'm too lazy now to learn another language. But so they speak English very well. And it's so beautiful up there. And there's so many lakes and rivers and streams and snow and beach, just a lot. And it's filled with lovely Canadians.
All right. So thank you very much, Brian. And thank you to Matt Sorum for the incredibly entertaining episode.
Yeah, it was a great, great fun to... it was great, great fun to sit down with my old buddy, Matt Sorum. He's a lovely guy, and I'm really happy for him the way things are turning out now, and he's got a kid on the way. It's lovely.
Awesome. All right, Brian, we'll see you next week.
Okay.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. On Tour and The After Show are productions of iHeartRadio and Black Barrel Media. This show is produced by me, Mandy Wimmer, with executive producer Noel Brown. For more information about On Tour, visit our website, blackbarrelmedia.com. For behind-the-scenes photos from these interviews or to submit questions for The After Show, visit our social media at On Tour on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. For more shows from iHeartRadio and Black Barrel Media, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.